Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, and boy, did that phrase ever have as much meaning as it is today. You have to work like a slave all day. Of course you work. Thanks, Fats. I appreciate it. Taxes, taxes, taxes. Certainty? In this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes. Said who? Whoever can guess who said nothing is certain but death and taxes and gets it up first in the Savage Nation wins a free copy of the Michael Savage Freedom of Speech Award. And I'll read you some other quotes. Who said certainty in this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes? I'm talking about taxes because the people who listen to this show, I would say, if you did it demographically, I would say a very large percentage of people who listen to the Savage Nation and talk radio in general are taxpayers, not tax consumers. In other words, deadbeat bums. Tax consumers, there's two type of Americas. There's two type of Americans. There are the taxpayers, you and I, and the tax consumers, the grifters, the bums, who take from us. Now, as you know, Tuesday is the deadline for filing federal income taxes. Half of American taxpayers will pay 97% of the individual income taxes the government will collect for this year. Okay? The other half of Americans will pay little or nothing in taxes, yet will continue to receive billions of your dollars in benefits in the form of subsidies, free services, cash, and other benefits and loans. So there are two Americans and two Americas, not the rich and the poor, not the black and the white, but taxpayers and tax consumers. And if a Democrat should win the White House, it's going to get tougher for you, the listener of the Savage Nation, the taxpayer. And so we're going to talk about the two Americas today on the Savage Nation. And I found something interesting in trying to we got a winner. We got a winner. No more calls on that. I said whoever can quote certainty in this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes wins a free copy of the Savage Nation Freedom of Speech Award DVD. Medford, Oregon. Jenny, go ahead, please. Who said that?
Hi, Dr. Savage. I love your
Hello.
Show. And the Thank answer you. Is Ben Franklin.
Bingo! Bong! Play a bong, some, for Jenny. Jenny, how did you know it was Ben Franklin who said that?
I remembered from learning it in high school. I believe it was one of the quotes.
See, now, you went to high school before you were taught that America is evil, the white man is a racist, and how to put a condom on a cucumber. You went to high school when you were still taught what it is to be an American. You went to high school when you were still taught who our founding fathers were. You went to high school, well, I don't have to continue, but you just won a prize.
Thank you.
So there are two Americas, those who pay taxes and those who take our taxes. And you want to hear something interesting? We try to find out the demographic breakdown of the taxpayer versus the tax consumer by race, doesn't exist. By ethnicity, doesn't exist. By immigrant status, doesn't exist. Do you know why it doesn't exist? Because your friends in the federal government who tabulate everything else according to race and ethnicity will not tabulate what percent of the population is paying taxes and what percent of various ethnic groups, that is, are using your taxes while contributing little or nothing. Isn't it odd that they will calculate what percent of various crimes are caused by white people, what percent of this, hate crimes, blah, 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 blah. But the IRS will not give us information as to what ethnic group contributes the most taxes. Now, I have a suspicion I know the answer to that one, which is why they will not do it. Because if you would ever find out that you're actually a slave class, you're liable to revolt against the takers, since you're the contributors. Did you hear what I said earlier? There are two Americas, the tax payer and the tax consumer. 50% of American taxpayers will pay 97% of the individual income taxes the government will collect for 08. The other 50% will pay little or nothing in tax, yet will receive billions of dollars in benefits in the form of you know what. In the form of you know what? Well, you know what? Public transportation, public roads, public utilities, public schools. What else are they getting? Welfare, free medical care, free legal care. Now, that means that there's a burden on you, the taxpayer, the productive members of society, who already work over half of your day, 50% of your day, 4 hours out of your eight-hour workday, to pay your federal, state, and local income taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes, tariffs, and fees. Did you hear me? But what about the illegal immigrants? Aren't they paying their fair share, for example? Or is this immigrant bashing when I tell you they're not? Who are the tax consumers? Do we have the data on that? Oh, we have some of it. It's very hard to find, but we have found some of it. And we'll get into that on the Savage Nation. But here are some other quotes about death and taxes. If you make any money, the government shoves you in the creek once a year with it in your pocket, and all it doesn't get wet, you can keep. Will Rogers. Ronald Reagan said the taxpayer, that's someone who works for the federal government, but doesn't have to take the civil service examination. Comedian Arthur Godfrey said, I'm proud to pay taxes in the United States. The only thing is I could be just as proud for half the money. Will Rogers said the income tax has made more liars out of the American people than golf has. Even when you make a tax form out on the level, you don't know when it's through if you are a crook or a martyr. H.L. Mencken, the humorist, said, unquestionably there is progress. The average American now pays out twice as much in taxes as he formerly got in wages. Thomas Paine said, what at first was plunder assumed the softer name of revenue. That's today. Now, I got to tell you something. I live in the highest taxed state in the United States of America, the late great state of California, where the tax rate is 10% of your income is stolen by the state in order to pay for illegal aliens and virtually everything else that the state uses the money on. The roads are broken. The public services are poor. $15 to $25 billion a year is spent on illegal aliens in this state alone. The money is stolen by us from us by the government of the state of California, for example. But wait, if you think that's bad, there's another 1% that's stolen in the state of California for anyone who makes more than $1 million a year. I said makes, not steals. That extra 1% supposedly goes for mental health tax. What does that mean? Whose mental health does it go for? 11% of your gross income is stolen by the state of California. Now, there are states where there are no state income taxes, as you know. Florida, which is why many wealthy people have sold all their property in high tax states such as this, have divested themselves of all of their connections to the state, and have left during the last tax rise. They went to Florida, Nevada, state of Washington, Wyoming, to name a few, New Hampshire. These are some of the zero tax states. Whether they will remain tax-free states is another question. I kind of doubt it. Because of the greedy people running states, I don't know how much longer this can go on. But I'll give you another quote about taxes. It was one of the top-ranking originators of communism in the last century, whether it was Lenin or Marx, who said that communism will succeed through one means only, taxes, taxes, and more taxes. So when you hear Barbara Boxer or any of the other far-left Democrats calling for higher taxes, you are hearing the naked communist. Remember, you don't know this, but last week the anti-global warming cap-and-trade system, anti-global warming, you see what they're using it for now? To rob you again. But who proposed it? Senator Joseph Lieberman, D. Connecticut, independent Democrat, and John Warner, R. Virginia, will require $1.3 trillion in new tax revenues over 10 years. For global warming? It's thievery, you know that. You know it very well. And it's going to get worse. Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat, Brooklyn, on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee said Lieberman Warner is merely a good starting point. She wants even more money. And what is it going to go for? More government, I can guarantee you. So there it is. Today is the day of taxes. Two Americas. We cannot get the data ethnically or any other way on who the taxpayers are and the tax consumers. My suspicion is I know who they are, though. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. We will go on to the callers. How do you like that? You want to talk about taxes for a few minutes? Because we can do that. Who do you think pays more taxes in this country? Well, let's put it another way so it's a little more sensitive. Which ethnic group, proportionate to their numbers, is a larger taxpayer than tax consumer? My guess is the white people. The white people are the patsies of the United States of America, blamed for everything bad and stolen from by the government to pay for those who frankly come here not to work but to take. That's my opinion. Prove me wrong. Get me the data that proves me wrong. How do you like that one? Let's go to the first caller, WTNT Washington, D.C. Ray, by the way, if you're listening to this program in Los Angeles on KLAA, and you are the first to call today, the Savage Nation, you're going to win a free prize. So be sure to call 1-800-449-8255. In Washington, Ray, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Michael. We're all slaves to this tax, and because we're being illegally taxed, whether and all our taxes actually don't go to run the government. I mean, they actually just go to pay the interest on the debt that the U.S. government owes the Federal Reserve, which is the illegal institution who runs our monetary policy now. So we're all slaves at this point, and until we get someone in there who's willing to make this change, the Fed hasn't...
All right, so there's a great question of the day. You have three candidates. The naked Marxist, Obama. You have the far-left, Hillary. And you have the old-line, middle-of-the-roader, McCain. Tell me which of the three is not going to raise taxes. You pick the pea out of those nuts, and I'll give you a prize. The answer is all of them are going to raise taxes. Now, the reasons are many. We have tens of millions of deadbeats in this country, bums who are able-bodied to refuse to work. Just turn on Cops or any other police show every night, and you'll see them. You'll see the low-life vermin in this country who, in fact, used to pick the vegetables, used to work in the slaughterhouses, used to clean the hotel rooms. But because they have too much time on their hands, they use drugs and beat up their wives. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It wasn't him, Charlie. It was you. Remember that night in the garden? You came down my dressing room and said, "Kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson." You remember that? This ain't your night. My night. I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been
Marlon
somebody.
Brando and Rod Steiger on the waterfront, where Marlon Brando was told to take a dive because his brother, the racketeer, had bet against him. Now, the reason I'm playing it is because there's rumors going around the Internet that McCain is actually setting it up so that Hillary wins, that McCain is setting it up to take a dive. Rumors that he doesn't want Obama to win because this and that. I mean, it's unbelievable what people are saying. Some of the things coming out of McCain's mouth, I'm sorry to tell you, I don't know whether to believe him or not. I mean, some of these rumors. Speaking of fights, this weekend in Vegas is the Calzacchi versus Hopkins fight. In Vegas, light heavyweight championship, Calzacchi is the undefeated Welsh fighter from Wales. Hopkins is, he lost one fight. I'm probably going to be at the fight because someone I know very well is sponsoring the fight. And I'll be in the third row looking for one of the presidential contenders to say. I don't think I'll be able to say hello this time. last fight I was at, I walked right up. I don't know. He had no Secret Service protection. He ran to me like my best friend. Oh, Cindy, look, it's Michael Savage. Like his oh, I like the man. I wanna love this guy. Something about it. I don't know. I can't do it. Something tells me I won't be able to run up to him this time. In fact, I'm not running up to anybody. I'm going to sit in that row there, which is like three, four rows back in the sponsors row, and drink my beer and watch the fight. I don't know who's going to win. I think Hopkins is going to beat Calzaghe, frankly. And I'm not really rooting for anybody. I don't know who Rockstar's backing. Are we backing the fight or the... It's my son does it. You know, do you realize what this is for me? When I was a kid, I would watch the Friday night fights in the little television set in the living room. My father was an avid fight fan. Every Friday, Gillette Blue Black. And it was this every Friday night before I started to be able to go out on Saturday nights. I must have been, you know, 15, you could go out already, 14, whenever. But I was home every Friday night, and I'd watch the fights with him. And I'd see the advertiser be Gillette Blue Blades for the quickest, like a shave of all, bung. I grew up on that stuff. Now you spin the clock ahead, calendar, 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 chew, 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 chew. Here we are, 08, and I'm going to Vegas, and it's my son sponsoring a fight. I have no idea how good. You know what this is to me? Poor grandpa was dead in 1970. I can't imagine what it would have meant to him. He would have been, God, almost 100 by now, but he didn't live too long. Poor guy worked his heart out. Worked his heart out so I could have a better life. Then, of course, my better life was stolen from me for 30 years by the liberals. But, you know, life goes on. Play the Friday Night Fights music. Yeah, let me hear if you go with you. There it is. Every Friday night. Thank you. I had an uncle who would, if you go to his house to watch the fights, he would actually, he was different. My father would watch it. There was no visceral reaction. The uncle, God bless him, I loved him dearly. He would move in that chair on that couch like he was taking the blows and giving the blows. He was engaged. You'd hear him groan when his guy got hit. You'd hear him, and we didn't know what to do. He'd get so engrossed in that TV set that we thought it would be bad for him. You know, it's different characters. We're all snowflakes, as I said. We're all different. We are. I have a whole thing with the snowflake thing. I'm becoming a soft-headed guy. We're all snowflakes. We're all unique. We're all different. It's the Savage Nation, Death and Taxes, right here on the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
I think those comments are elitist. I think that anybody who disparages people who are hardworking, honest, dedicated people who have cherished the Second Amendment and the right to hunt and the right to observe that and their values and their culture.
Wait. Here's the part I don't understand. Why are they all supporting the right to hunt when the majority of gun owners don't own guns to hunt? What are they missing here? Are they missing? He's not an elitist for saying that everyone owns a gun is hunting. I don't hunt and I own a lot of guns. They're purely for home defense, not for hunting, okay? What's this hunting? Don't you understand what these elitists are doing, whether it's Hillary or McCain trying to separate themselves from Obama with this story about guns and God? They're saying, well, okay, well, we're different. We're for the average guy, the Joe Sixpack. We understand your love for hunting. Well, that's all well and good, but the majority of gun owners, I can guarantee you, are not hunters. That's my guess. The majority of gun owners today own guns strictly for self-defense or home defense, not for hunting. So I don't like this, that another to own a gun, you need to go hunting? No. The Second Amendment's not about hunting. Yeah, not at all. No, not at all. It's about self-defense, particularly defense against an overbearing, overreaching government, my friends. Let's never forget that. Let's never forget that our good friend Adolf Hitler in Germany, one of the first acts he committed was to seize all the guns in Germany and Pol Pot in Cambodia and Fidel Castro in Cuba. Dictators always seize guns because they understand that a well-armed citizenry is a dangerous citizenry, a defenseless citizenry, and they don't want anyone to be able to stand up to them. Don't you get it? Well, let's go back to the issue of taxes. We have a caller out of Los Angeles on my affiliate, KLAA 830 on the Dial E. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm basically, I'm an accountant in Los Angeles, 31 years old, at my own small firm, and almost every one of my clients are liberal young people in their 20s and 30s, every single one of them, actors, musicians, artists, and I use this opportunity when they get upset about how much they're paying in taxes to point out that, you know, Obama, for example, has said that he's going to raise taxes and that this is something they should be very concerned with, and obviously they are. I mean, I've even had a few people.
Wait. Do they come to their senses when they realize that what they're saying may have consequences in their pocketbook?
Yeah, I think so a little bit. I mean, a couple people, I hate to say I dissuaded people from voting for Obama. I mean, I suppose that is a good thing, but I feel I shouldn't be. But I have told a few people that have supported him that he is for it. He said it on record. He's going to raise their taxes. And these are the very people that have been most upset and just cannot believe, especially as Californians, what is happening with their taxes. They cannot believe.
Well, don't they realize that 10% of their gross goes to state taxes under Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said he would balance the budget?
For most young people, this is a huge shock. You know, we're just now starting to pay taxes, just now getting into our careers, and we all of a sudden make a little bit of money, and they're taking tons and tons of it away.
Well, it's true. That's right. The minute you start to pay taxes, you come to become a little bit less fanatic about your left-wing philosophies. But do they understand that higher federal taxes are typically followed by more spending, and that requires additional taxation? And then with this tax and spend cycle comes more burdensome bureaucrats, more regulation, and productive businesses and entrepreneurial energies are throttled, and that throttles the taxpaying segment of the economy. They don't get that, do they? And if they want to start talking about, you know, turning this country into the ex-Soviet Union, they have to understand it by voting for a guy like Obama. That's where he's going to take us. So what do the lib clients say when they realize how much they're paying in taxes? You're an accountant in L.A.
I'm an accountant in L.A. And they get very upset. They think that they're just – it's totally unfair. They think they're being robbed. They actually
– Oh, in other words, they shouldn't pay taxes. Only conservatives should?
Well, or just the people that they consider to be rich, I guess. I mean, it's really...
I get it. So, in other words, the graduated income tax isn't graduated enough for them. What tax bracket are these people in? What do they earn, the type you're talking about?
Definitely $30,000 to $40,000.
All right. And they feel their taxes are too high, and only people who earn over 100 grand, 150,000 should pay more tax, not them?
Exactly. They feel that they're for their level. And you want one more thing. When it comes to Social Security, though, God forbid they ever lost Social Security. A lot of them, that's when they start talking about, laughing about, you know, getting guns. And, you know, that's when the only thing that really upsets them also is the thought that maybe...
Well, there's an old adage. It's not funny anymore, but it's true. You know, what do you call a liberal with two children? And the answer is a Republican. But that doesn't work anymore because liberals never have two children. They never get that far. Thanks for the call. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Hamas says Carter will help us engage the world community. Now, Hamas is a member of the International Terrorist Brigades. It's known as a terrorist organization by the United States government and every civilized country on earth. And here's Jimmy Carter, the well-known Jew hater from the south lands of America, from the southeast, a man who... cannot stop hating Jews for some reason. He would take terrorist Arabs over a Jew any day. He now goes and engages the Hitlers of our time. It's unbelievable to me how this man gets away with it. This is the same anti-American Jimmy Carter who, as I said to you 1,000 times, if I've said it once, helped undermine the Shah of Iran, forced the Shah into exile, brought back the murderer, Ayatollah Khomeini, from exile in Paris. The Ayatollah Khomeini came back from Paris, and the virus of radical Islam has now spread around the world. He is the causation of the cancer of radical Islam, Jimmy Carter, and he has not stopped yet. This man, in my opinion, should be arrested upon his arrival back in the U.S. That's what I think of Jimmy Carter. It's unbelievable to me. But you think Jimmy Carter's bad, you're right. Obama's no better. There's a great article out today from the National Review on Obama's America-hating friends. And they list Obama's America-hating friends. We know about the Reverend Wright. We don't have to waste our time with that, with him. We know what he is. Have you heard of Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn? Well, why is Obama so friendly to Bill Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, a pair of terrorists? And they're not terrorist sympathizers. They're terrorists. You'll have to read about that. You'll find out who these people are, and you have to ask yourself why he hangs around with these barbaric individuals. Find out why Obama is friendly with a man named Rashid Khalidi and who he is. I suggest you go to my website and read the article, because I'm not going to read it for you. Taxes. Tony, 8:30 on the dial again, Los Angeles. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. I want to talk about dissolving Social Security. But first, I started listening to you on 8:30. I think it was back in October. And I realized after, you know, a few weeks or a couple months that not only are you the best storyteller, but you're the most informative. I learned more than, you know, listening to you than the golfer and the wall banger. And the difference between you and the people, those other conservative radio talk show hosts that blackball you, is that the audience has to lead them to what to do, what's right, and talk about what's right. You are always leading, and you're always telling us, hey, this is the way to go. And
I understand. Well, the wall banger is probably a very nice guy, as is the golfer. I actually think they're very nice. I can't say that for the leprechaun. I don't think he's very nice. By what I hear, the golf is probably a decent man, and so is Wallbanger. I hear the leprechaun's an SOB. Everyone who meets him says the same thing. But that's irrelevant. What's relevant is you, the listener. And I'm glad that you enjoy the show, particularly in Los Angeles. It's a great, a very important market. So you're talking about taxes, Tony? What's on your mind?
Well, I think Social Security, in my own way, I think it should be dissolved. And I think if it was, I think it would be better for the families because, you know, some of the older people, they think they can live off their $1,000 a month check or whatever. But back, probably going back 60 years or 40 years, you know, when it first started under FDR.
Yeah, let me ask you something. I'm going to ask you a question and anyone else, and I'll give you the answer. Who do you think are more likely to be dependent on Social Security benefits for most or all of their retirement income? Elderly white Americans or elderly African American folks?
Well, I would probably say elderly blacks, because a lot of elderly whites have their own businesses and they have probably some kind of social network with their family also.
African American retirees are more likely than whites to rely on Social Security as their only income in old age. It's the sole source of retirement income for 40% of elderly African Americans, according to the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. And so every time I hear whites being bashed, I can't take it anymore, to be honest with you. I feel as though I'm carrying the whole society on my back. I have paid through affirmative action. I have paid through higher taxation. I have paid through the nose, and I'm sick of it, to be honest with you. And frankly, nobody is speaking out for me. Tell me who speaks for me in this country. Tell me who represents me, the taxpayer, who's paid through affirmative action, through welfare, through this, through that, high taxation to support everybody on the earth. Tell me who speaks for me. John McCain? How come John McCain won't talk about taxation? How come no one will even ask any of them about taxation? Have you heard one conversation about taxation yet amongst all of these idiots in the media, in all of their so-called debates and interviews? I haven't.
It's taxation without representation. That's the problem.
Well, wait, I'm asking you, but do you think McCain is not going to raise taxes?
Well, I think just his global warming policy, it's going to be very hard.
If John McCain, I call him John McCain affectionately because it reminds me of Tom McCann, the shoe store, and he looks like a shoe salesman half the time, God bless his soul. If John McCain believes man is responsible for global warming and that we need to pay a $1.3 trillion tax to stop global warming, then John McCain is no better than Hillary Clinton in that regard. What's the choice here? Thanks for the call. That's all. That's the problem. That's why I'm not too excited about the election. I'm really not excited. The only one I don't want to win is Obama, because I know he's a Marxist in his heart. He's an Afro-Leninist, and I know he's dangerous. Hillary, I know what to expect from her, which is 8 horrible years, but I'm not so sure she's still a Leninist. Her husband has made so much money in so many different capitalist ways that I actually think they've matured and become good Americans. No, there's a paradoxical statement I've just made. In other words, I think the Clintons probably started out as far leftist characters in their early years, but they've been around so long in the power structure, and now finally they've been allowed to make so much money, and they've circulated with the rich for so long that I think she's a safe bet. In fact, there's an argument to be made that she might be a safer bet than McCain in that regard. The only thing you're going to get different between Hillary and McCain, as I can tell it, Hillary, you're going to get more of the lesbian feminist propaganda thrown in your face than with McCain. But other than that, it's going to be almost the same exact administration. There really is no difference, except now here's an important difference in the presentation. You know how I've said for years, you know, the Queen of England is sort of a figurehead. McCain would make for a better figurehead than Hillary Clinton. And frankly, Cindy McCain would be a better first lady than would be Bill Clinton. I'll take Cindy McCain as first lady any day rather than, what would they call Bill Clinton if he's back in the White House? First man? First gentleman? No, that's impossible. They would have to change the designation. He could not be considered first gentleman if he were in the White House, because we know what kind of naughty things he did in the pantry there. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Giving it what Condoleezza Rice calls a congenital birth defect. They had intelligence, but they had no wisdom. Thomas Jefferson, in his notes on Virginia, write it down, query number 18, said that God would punish America for the sin of slavery. I guess that makes Thomas Jefferson unpatriotic.
That is the voice of Barry Obama's preacher saying that the man who put together the nation planted white supremacy, and God would punish America for the sin of slavery, according to Thomas Jefferson. Well, of course, it was a white man named Thomas Jefferson who said that, and that doesn't mean that all founding fathers were planting the seeds of slavery, but don't tell that to Reverend Wright, because by definition, if he says that the founding fathers planted white supremacy into the DNA of this country, then he quotes one of the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, who says God would punish America for the sin of slavery, it means he's selectively choosing to say that all of the founding fathers were white supremacists without giving any credit to Thomas Jefferson, who was obviously not. And so therefore, he is showing himself to be a racist SOB through and through, a hater of white people. And if it is true that God... it is said God would punish America for the sin of slavery, we have been punished quite enough just listening to this despicable character, Reverend White. Norfolk, Virginia, Charles, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Michael, I was camera crew for one of the cable news networks that's been keeping tabs on what Wright has been saying recently when he spoke here yesterday at a church in Norfolk. And it was a perfect example that I've seen of him wanting the freedom of speech, but he's also wanting to be selective as to who hears what he says. And he's really using, the ability to tell people.
Well, wait. Well, you're talking about Reverend Wright, so-called Reverend. He's a reverend like, some reverend. What does he revere, I'd like to know? Sounds like he reveres Das Kapital by Karl Marx. He's a hater. There's no question about it. What did he do that offended you?
Well, they had a sign up that said no recording devices were to be used in the church. So we were restricted to putting our cameras outside of the church, you know, on public property and shooting his arrival and whatever went on. They did open it up to the public at the last minute. And we went in and sat in the overflow room to listen to what he was saying. But they were confiscating, there were a lot of print people there. So they were.
What is it that he's afraid of that people will hear him say that he would not want anyone to record it? I mean, who got us these recordings at the Bank Street Memorial Baptist Church in Norfolk? Is that the church you're referring to?
Exactly, Michael.
Somebody was in there with a recorder, because we hear the man saying these horrible things about our founding fathers.
Well, that was the lady from the Chicago Tribune. She was the only one to be able to get something in. Michael, what it is it's selective freedom of speech. In other words, it's like Obama.
Yeah, look, I'm fighting the CAIR group on the freedom of speech issue. They want to kill my free speech while enjoying free speech to kill it in this country. You understand how it works.
Absolutely, Michael. I'm very close to a lady that wrote a book called Because They Hate, and she knows what that's all about.
Well, I think that this Reverend Wright, frankly, has been a tremendous asset for America in that that really started America asking themselves about Barry Obama and who he really is. And I think that he's never recovered from that one, despite the fact that the midstream media tells us that he has recovered from it. He never recovered from that. And Barry Obama then showed himself, I think, in his true feelings in Pennsylvania with the guns and the Bible the other, guns and God the other day. I mean, this guy is not an elitist. That's the wrong word. What makes him an elitist? I wouldn't call him an elitist. I hate that word. There's another word for Barry Obama other than elitist. Wouldn't you agree, Charles? Yeah, well, I know what the word is. I can't use it on the radio. That's all. He's not an elitist at all. I don't like the word elitist. It means elitist means they're better than the average person. You're already putting them into another category. He's not better than the average person. He's a hustler. Barry Obama has used race all his life to hustle his way to where he is today. You want me to level with you? You want me to take off my gloves and give you the unvarnished truth about Barry Obama? He's used race all of his life to get over on guilty white liberals who have ushered him all the way up to where he is today. And I told you 100 times that the veneer is coming off this guy. And what you see underneath it is his preacher, Reverend Wright. That's what's underneath the veneer. So I think it'll be a very interesting next few months. But don't lose sight of the biggest problem we have. It's not Obama. It's not Hillary. It's not McCain. The biggest problem we have is named George Bush. I told you that George Bush, with all the damage he's done to this country in the last number of years, is nothing compared to what he's going to do between now and when he leaves office. I told you that, and I told it to you 2-3 months ago. Have I been wrong? You've seen nothing yet. You have seen nothing yet. This man is a clear and present danger to the survival of this country. He has broken our borders. He's broken our currency. He's broken our borders, our language and our culture and our financial system. What is next? Well, he tried to break our legal system by siding with the international court against a Mexican murderer, rapist. How much worse does it get? Tune in, you'll find out right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Ever since I've been a little girl, felt the presence of God in my life. And it's been a gift of grace that has, for me, been incredibly
sustaining. I listen to politicians, my prostate hurts.
But really, ever since I was a child, I have
felt
the
listening to Hillary increases prostatitis.
Of God.
And I know it doesn't decrease it.
Experiences on many, many occasions where I felt
God?
Like the Holy Spirit was there
me
as I made.
Oh, yeah. The blue dress was probably one of those nights. Play it. The whole thing.
You know, it could be taking a walk in the
woods. All right. So the interviewer next asks Hillary, be specific where you felt the Holy Spirit. Here's 04.
You know, it could be taking a walk in the woods. It could be watching the sunset. But I don't think that I could have made my life's journey without.
Look, it's not her I'm laughing at as much as the process of becoming president.
Having that you know, sense of forgiveness and unconditional love.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mena Airport, there was a lot of forgiveness and love down there. Oh, yeah. There was an awful lot of forgiveness in the Clinton White House. You know, the embarrassing thing is how we conduct elections in America, not so much what Hillary is saying. What kind of stupid questions are these from idiots in the media? Compassion Forum. Who cares about any of this with regard to the future of America? I want to hear about how she's going to protect us from Islamofascists. How is she going to slam Islamofascists? How is she going to do a better job at killing Islamofascists? When is she going to destroy them once and for all? Number two, when is she going to lower taxes and reduce the size of government? Frankly, if she'd answer those questions, plus when is she going to secure the border, she got my vote. But they don't ask her those questions. They ask stupid things like this. Now listen to this idiocy in clip seven.
Senator, we've heard about HIV/AIDS. Many people here are concerned about Darfur and a number of other humanitarian issues. Why do you think it is that a loving God allows innocent people to suffer?
Oh, wait a minute. This is really getting mushy. This is really mushy. This is like, why do good people suffer bad things?
Yeah.
You know, this is stupid. Yeah. Well, let me hear what the philosopher Clinton said.
Of generations of commentary and debate.
Does she answer it or not?
And I don't know. I can't wait to ask him because I've...
All right, that's a good answer.
I have just pondered it.
But she said him. That's even a better answer. Thank God she didn't say, I can't wait to ask her. Next, some dimwit in the media asks her about a loving God, about her favorite Bible story. Listen to 08.
Do you have a favorite Bible story?
Oh, I have so many of them. You know, I was fortunate as a child growing up to be read Bible stories, to go to Sunday school, to go to Bible school. And Bill and I read, you know, Bible stories to Chelsea. You know, I have talked about Bible stories and parables.
Bill's favorite Bible story is, I can't say anything about salami,
friends.
Sorry.
And, you know, it depends upon what's going on in my life at the time. The recent...
All right. In other words, she doesn't know one story from the Bible. She's hemming and hawing. They ask me, I'll tell them Ezekiel. I wouldn't say Bible story. I would say favorite Bible biblical passages. I could quote a little Ezekiel or Jeremiah if you'd like. Now, finally, there's another one. Hillary asks if she believes God wants her to be president. Listen to the next.
Do you believe God wants you to be president?
Well,
You see, this is America. We even mock God while pretending to talk about. Turn it off. See, even while pretending to talk about a topic as so serious to so many millions of Americans, the morons in the atheistic media, in the midstream media, mock God by asking such a foolish question. And it diminishes us as a nation to have lightweights like this asking questions like this. Crazy. The whole thing's crazy. Who could pay attention to this anymore? You know, really care? I filled my gas tank Saturday. It cost me $75. I'm not a poor man, but I felt it. Now, what if I were not a rich man? I'm in the media. I make a good living. I'm not going to lie to you. There were years I didn't make a good living. There are years I drove a broken Volvo with a 4-speed on the floor with two young children, one of whom wore Oshkosh Bagosh because I couldn't afford to buy new clothing. There were years that I didn't buy new shoes for one of my children because I couldn't afford a new pair of shoes. And when I bought one, I had to think about it because I was not a rich person. Now, what if I had to fill a gas tank and I was that guy today? Like 30, 32 years old with two kids, whatever. And I wasn't making a lot of money, and I filled my tank, and it cost me $75 to fill the tank. You think I want to hear this rubbish about your favorite Bible story? What I would ask her is, what are you going to do to lower the price of gasoline? When are you going to make the Iraqis pay for the cost of the war? Why don't you make the Mexicans pay for the cost of carrying the illegal aliens on our back? See, this is what I mean by beware the government media complex. You think you're getting a free election here? You're out of your mind. It's all a setup, the whole thing. KNEW, San Francisco, Zora, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, if you lived in ancient Iran, the king will go ahead and give you pieces of jewelry and bars of gold for how you just put the truth in such a beautiful, naked way. You would be the wealthiest man in the world. The whole
You're talking about ancient Persia when there were kings who understood beauty. We don't have such kings in America, do we? We have politicians who don't understand beauty at all.
And the root of all of our problem in the world is two words I say, Jimmy Carter. He took the stabilizer of the whole Middle East out and brought a bunch of life-wearing bearded...
Jimmy Carter caused the cancer of radical Islam to disseminate around the globe. For that alone, he should be in prison. But to add insult to injury, to now go and meet the terrorists in Hamas, I do not understand why his passport is not seized.
The people of America will not stand and say something. It's beyond me. He destroyed...
But I'm saying something. Who was the greatest king of Persia?
I would go ahead and say Nader. The one who conquered...
Nader, Ralph Nader's ancestors were kings?
Yeah, it was a Nader, and his last name was A-F-S-H-A-R.
There were great Persian kings, and there were despotic Persian kings. There were good Persian kings. There were evil Persian kings. There were enlightened Persian kings, and there were Hitler-like Persian kings. We know that. But today what you have is a throwback to King Haman in Persia right now, in Iran. This little guy who wears platform shoes in Iran is a throwback to the worst the Iranian people have ever seen. Would you agree with that?
I would agree 100%, and I'll tell you, I pray for you to be safe and sound, to be speaking the truth every night.
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying. That's a nice... Fortunately, I hear you. Thank you for the call. We'll let it go at that. No, this can't go on much longer. How long do you think people in the media are going to be able to speak their mind? Tell me how much longer. Tell me how much longer. You're telling me that Tom McCann, the shoe salesman, is not going to go along with the power structure, both Demon Cat and Republicrat, to knock out talk radio. You're telling me they want anyone telling the truth about what they're doing? Don't be stupid. You're listening to the last great years of freedom of speech in this country. I'm telling you. I'm very lucky. I'm telling you, I've had 15 of the best years of my life. It's why I won't let go of this merry-go-round. All my life, I was trying to grab that gold ring, and I did. And believe me, it slipped out of my hands in the beginning. I couldn't get it. I was on a horse going sideways, not up and down, and that ring was up, not sideways. I finally grabbed it. And people say, well, you've done it all. You knocked it out of the park, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you just let it go now? I can't let it go. The people need me, and I need the people. I'm addicted to this radio show. But having said that to you, and I don't want to alarm you, I truly believe we're coming to the end of freedom of speech and freedom of the press in this country. And it's going to come not from our enemies without, but from our enemies within. And they're going to couch it under the guise of, for peace and stability, we must curtail certain speech in this country. We're not going to curtail speech. We believe in free speech, but we don't believe in hate speech. Now, what's hate speech? Why, that's anything they want to call hate speech. You see, the people who started this, of course, are a certain subsect of America. They're the sexual deviants. But they think anybody who stands up to their agenda is a hate speaker. Now, of course, if you're a Democrat, anything Republican is hate speech. If you're a Republican, anything Democrats hate speech. And let me remind you of something else. Our First Amendment, created by the founding fathers who Reverend Wright hates. I'd like to know who his founding fathers were, by the way, what they created in Africa. Did they give a good constitution from the country he came from? I'd like to see it. Maybe it's better than my founding fathers. I'd like to see the constitution from Africa, where Reverend Wright came from, his ancestors, if that founding document has as many freedoms for me as the documents called the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution that Reverend Wright hates so much and mocks so much. But let me say this to you, and I'll say it again. The First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, was not written by the founding fathers to protect polite speech. How many times do I have to say the same thing to you until you understand it? The First Amendment was written by the founding fathers to protect offensive speech. Nobody needs to protect polite speech of the type you hear Hillary giving or McCain giving or Obama giving. That's all polite speech. It's nothing. It's meaningless. They're hallmark cards. Who's going to take offense? You may disagree with it, but you're not offended by it. They don't need the First Amendment to say those things. I need the First Amendment. It's I who the founding fathers wrote it for. I am the last beacon of truth in talk radio. And so are the others who speak out. We're the last beacons in this dark sea and this fermenting sea that is fomenting around us. We are the lighthouses of truth in America. Not these dunces and these fools in the mainstream, midstream media. They don't need the First Amendment. They're afraid of their own shadow. We are the ones for whom the First Amendment was written. It's impolite speech. It's vigorous speech. It's offensive speech that the First Amendment was written for. Don't ever forget it. And opposing it are the Republicans and the Democrats. Don't ever forget that either. I'll be right back. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
It is 23, almost 24 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the one and only Savage Nation. Coming up after this segment, I have a novelist, Colin Harrison, with his new novel, The Finder. I really enjoyed reading it. I haven't read a novel in a long time. I grew up reading them, but we'll talk about that and novel writing and the nature of writing today shortly after this segment. Right now, let's go to the callers in the general political arena. WOR New York, Bob, welcome to the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Hey, Mike, you often talk about the average Roman caring about the pebble in his shoe. My question is, what is the Arab's pebble in the shoe? You know, these people live in crap, and they just care about killing Jews and Americans. What do you think is the deal with these people?
I think I can answer that question. I'll turn it around a little bit. You're asking us why the Arab world hates the world so much other than their own world. Is that what you're saying? Why the Arab world seems to hate everyone except the Arab world?
I'll give you
part of the answer. The answer is it can be found in the imams, those hateful throwback little men with the dirty beards and the dirty nightshirts who preach hatred to them day and night, inculcating hatred in their minds. Now, let me give you an example. In this country, when we find a hater, as we have with Obama's preacher, we rightly make an issue of a preacher who's supposed to be a man of peace and a man of love, that is a man of God. We make an issue of a man of hate who opposes as a man of love. That's why Wright's hatred for white America has become such an issue in this country, because they are the exception, not the norm. Most preachers in this country teach peace and love, not hatred. Reverend Wright, in other words, would be akin to most of the imams in the world of hatred, the sea of hatred that is being fomented by these throwbacks. That's my opinion. The problem begins and ends with these throwback imams. And unless the Arab world throws them out of their temples, they're always going to hate. So I don't think I'm answering your question directly, but I'm answering it indirectly, Bob. I know where the problem lies. It's with the imams.
Yeah, appreciate that, Michael. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, you ask for an answer. That's one man's opinion. I could be wrong, but I kind of doubt it. I kind of think I'm right. If you raise your children to hate, if you raise your children to hate another race and another religion and call them dogs and pigs, what do you think those children are going to grow up and be? Huh? They're going to grow up to be Hamas, the people that Jimmy Carter can't seem to get enough of, the people he can't seem to wait to break pita bread with. But you think these poor children in those regions are not being taught to kill and to hate? You're mistaken. And who's teaching it to them? The hateful, retrograde, throwback imams in their holy places, so-called holy places. The solution to this is very complicated, and I don't have the immediate answer. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at some of the things they're teaching, here you have Hamas preachers, what they're saying to the children. Hamas, a member of parliament, Islamic conquest very soon. WorldNet Daily today. I think it's up on my, linked up on michaelsavage.com. The things they're teaching their children, calling Jews the descendants of animals who were put in the Middle East by the crusader and has planted the Brothers of Apes and Pigs in Palestine. Who said a thing like that? Yunus al-Astala, Muslim cleric, said in the April 11th broadcast on a Hamas's Al-Aqsa TV, "Very soon, Allah willing, Rome will be conquered just like Constantinople was, as was prophesied by our prophet Muhammad." Now, when you put out this kind of hatred under the guise of religion, and you got a bunch of ignorant morons sitting there who don't have the education, let's say, of an average fifth grader in America, what do you think these ignorant morons are going to believe when they walk out of that house of hatred? They're going to believe that Jews are the descendants of apes and pigs, and that every Christian is a crusader. And what are they going to want to do to the apes and pigs and to the crusader? Because of these retrograde throwbacks talking to the moron is going to go out and scream and want to kill. So there's your answer. At least that's a symptom of the problem. I don't have the answer. when you have a billion people being brainwashed on a daily basis by these throwbacks, and you have the Arab sheiks and the Arab princes and the Arab kings who have trillions of dollars who could control this, but instead they're doing the opposite by sending these hateful monsters to our own country to preach the same hatred, and our politicians will not stop it. My friend, the prognosis is not very good.
Savage.
Death and taxes, the only certainty, according to Benjamin Franklin. We're talking about those topics here on the Savage Nation, when you think about it. As you know, I've been reading again. I started as a reader, got my PhD because I was a reader. I grew up reading a lot of fiction, then a lot of, you know, scholarly stuff, then a lot of fiction. And I stopped reading fiction because I went into the political realm. But recovering from pneumonia, I started reading again. And I stumbled upon a really good novel, Colin Harrison's The Finder. I can't summarize what the topic is about, but it's a thriller, and it's set in New York City from a man who knows New York City. And it's very exciting, actually, the way it's written. And we have the author with us now on The Savage Nation. Colin Harrison, welcome to The Savage Nation.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mr. Harrison, you know, here's a couple of questions. I've read a lot of novels in my life. Some of them are entertaining. Some are very insightful. But very few actually teach people very much. Your book, this one, The Finder, does a lot of different things. I learned a lot about the financial manipulation of these traders who are actually making stocks rise. How did you learn about these techniques that are sometimes used by unscrupulous traders?
Well, you're referring to a part of the story in which these unscrupulous traders are trying to raise the price of a stock in order to get back money that they feel has been taken from them.
Right.
And, you know, if you live in New York and you read the newspaper and you talk to people in the financial business, you pretty quickly get the sense that there's a lot of stuff that goes on that really doesn't quite make it, you know, out into the wider world. And there are guys who figure out how to do things they shouldn't be doing. And, you know, just last week there was a story about guys who were arrested for stock manipulation, and it goes on all the time. And I have a feeling
I know that, but I never knew how it was done. I mean, you really – this is not the whole book, but set up with China and trading against America in the middle of the night – and you say Elliott's platform trades were hidden within the general movement of the stock. With the SEC to examine it, they wouldn't find it. I thought you really must have done your homework to figure this one out, because when I watched the Bear Stern meltdown a few weeks ago, to me, it looked like an insider deal. I mean, I'm not asking you to comment if you don't care to. If you do, by all means. It certainly doesn't look as though it happened on its own.
You know, I don't know what happened there. I'm not an expert on Bear Stearns by any means. It's hard to imagine, though, that somebody didn't make money on this at some point.
Right. Somebody made a lot of money, and a lot of people lost their life savings. So then the novel is well written, and I'll tell you, I was, you know, although it's a popular novel written to become a film or something, I can see that. I almost can envision who's playing the movie. It actually moved me in certain places, the play between the dying father, the cop, the ex-cop, and his son. I thought that was very touching. And your description of this guy, Martz, sort of like an evil, old, you know, curmudgeonly capitalist. I want to read this. And he says, you wrote this. He said, there was something diseased and awful about Martz, predatory, vulturish. His many hundreds of millions made by buying and selling the work of others, never had created or produced or invented anything himself, just slithered in when companies were weak or underfunded, or down on their luck and sunk in his money-sucking fangs. It seems to me you met a few of these characters in your life.
Well, of course. Come on. New York City is the place to go, you know, if you want to do this. And
But come on. You're invited to the $40 million apartment. You're the novelist. They humor you, but they know they need you around to make it seem more artistic. But they must understand you're sizing them up.
Oh, constantly. And, you know, if you're a novelist in New York City and you have any kind of pretension of making some kind of social comment, and I would put myself in that category, you're always watching people, you're always thinking about what's going on, and you know, if you get invited in, they may think, oh, he's not checking me out. But, of course, I always am.
Well, I recently met someone who meets this category of a predator and vulturish who really has never created a product in his life. But he made several hundred million dollars, I heard, just simply by moving in when a company was weak, almost on the order of Mr. Soros. And although I am a capitalist at heart, I can't understand how this kind of thing is permitted. I don't know how that works even. It's so antithetical to my nature as a worker and a producer of things that I don't understand how anybody can make money by not making something. You know what I'm saying to me? It sounds illegal. But then again, I don't control the system. So the book is called The Finder. How would you describe it to the general listener, the Savage Nation? What would you say to them why they would want to read it? I hate to put you on the spot, but go ahead if you want.
Okay. You know, I was trying to write a story that once you got started, you could not put down. And, of course, all writers do that. They try to do that. And I wanted to have a strong female character and a strong male character that you wanted to follow. And the story is kind of shameless in its willingness to go to bad places and see people do bad things. And it probably doesn't reflect well on me, but I'm interested in seeing those things and writing about those things. And if
you mean like the seedy, slummy Gowanus Canal area or way out in the flats of Red Hook, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's what appealed to me, is that you weren't just writing. Let's go back to like Tom Wolfe, you know, his novels, which were very interesting and very entertaining and actually really fine as American novels. But he never wrote about this kind of seamy side. Maybe he did in passing, but he never really dwelled on them as you do. You went into these places and dwelled on them.
Well, I live in Brooklyn, you know, and I'm in Manhattan all the time, and I see all the high-toned places and so forth. But there's a lot of human reality going on in other places in New York City. New York City is not just what happens above the 40th floor between, you know, downtown Manhattan and 55th Street. There's a lot of other stuff that goes on.
No, I hear you. I hear you. In fact, I've asked, and you said something interesting, Colin. You said that you couldn't put it down. I read it over a couple of day period. You know, I'm recovering from pneumonia, so I started to stay home a lot in between doing the radio show. And frankly, I enjoyed reading it. I couldn't wait for the show to be over after dinner to sit down and read. And it was a great change for me because I had become an inveterate, crazy television movie watcher. You know, I have this cable system like everyone does with unbelievable numbers of movies. The problem is not many of them are really that engaging. Some really are. Some aren't. But the book relaxed me. I was able to sleep better reading again than I can watching television movies. It's amazing the different brainwaves it seems to induce reading.
Well, you know, there's nothing like a book, and books can do things that other forms can't do. And if you are, if you come to a book with a lot of concentration and the book is equal to your attention, you can have a great experience. I mean, that experience has been going on for thousands of years. And
I'm lucky I grew up on books, so to me, going back to them is a natural thing. But the kids today did not grow up turning pages. They grew up flipping screens.
It's true. You know, a lot of kids have read the Harry Potter books, my kids included, but I do worry about the attention span pressed upon the brains of these kids. It's definitely something to worry about.
Colin, let me ask you a political question. Your book, one of the things I liked about it was not very political in the sense of, you know, putting down a Republican or a Democrat at all. I didn't see any of that in it, thank God, because I didn't buy the book. I didn't read the book to get a political lesson. But I noticed some of it seeped out, and I don't know that you could want to answer this, but you're talking about people who manipulate stocks, and this character who does it, this guy, I think it's Martz, who knows how to do this. And I'm going to read you what you write about it. It said, and he wouldn't do this for anybody. The stock had, and you said he wouldn't do it. He had certain standards, in other words, this stock manipulator. He said it couldn't involve weapon systems or personal belief of his, and it couldn't directly enrich any of a select group of people, including Rupert Murdoch, Donald Rumsfeld, or George Soros. Elliot had a few standards. I wonder why you inserted that.
you're very sharp to point that out. I'm quite amused. I put that in there as kind of a wild card key to his personality. He's a unreconstructed capitalist. He's as greedy as they come, but he clearly has some kind of political opinion. And I just thought that it was an interesting paradox that he might have a problem with those characters and yet be an unreconstructed capitalist. And I think that greed cuts.
I know, but you were never published, I would assume, by the first aforementioned of the three men mentioned. Yeah. Nor do I think that he's going to option the movie rights to your book. That was one of the – then you make one reference to Donald Trump, which I thought was cute. It was the only other political statement, which I won't read here. I'll let the people find it themselves. But I thoroughly enjoyed The Finder by Colin Harrison. Now, you're a lifetime New Yorker, Colin, right, Colin Harrison?
I was born in New York. I lived as a kid away from New York, but I've been in the city for 20-something years now.
Well, how come you don't sound like me? I was born in New York and lived in New York and left New York so long ago. I'm the only one left with a New York accent, and I haven't lived there for 30 years.
Well, probably because my parents were not from New York.
Aha. Well, you sure have the pulse of the city in your hand, and I like the play on the China, the people from China and how they see America from the point of view of predatory capitalism and how they almost salivate at the thought of a war in the future. That was somewhat political. But at the end of the day, it's not really about any of those things. It's a novel. It's meant to entertain. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. I want you to get in the story and just go.
No, I did. Once I started reading it, I really couldn't put it down. And I recommend your book, The Finder. In fact, I asked my producer to ask your publicist to send your other books, The Havana Room and Afterburn and Manhattan Nocturne. If I like this book, which one of those am I going to like the best?
That's a good question. I would say, Afterburn is probably my wildest book. It's a little bit uncombed and wild. Havana Room is the last book before this. You might like that. There's some China in there.
Okay.
They're all.
Well, I wish you luck with it. I think it's good. I can't wait to see the movie version. In fact, I think I know who should play the dying cop.
I wish you would tell me.
I think I have a perfect character for it. Let me see if we can put our heads together. There was a character who played a tough old Irish detective, a retired Irish homicide detective, who he played in a movie that was done years ago, perfect for this role. Like as hard as nails, one of those kind of guys that are still around vaguely, but they're mainly retired. Oh, would he be perfect for that? I'll tell you what, if I could find the character's name on IMDb, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Colin Harrison, good luck with The Finder. Thanks for being on The Savage Nation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, I never do novels. You know that. I don't think I've done Beowulf, have I done a novel on this show in years, ever? 15 years? Maybe once or twice. Yes, we did. Who did we do? Who was the author that we did maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago? Do you remember? Nelson DeMille. Nelson DeMille was on the show years ago when he did a book about germ warfare. I thought that was good. We should do more novels. Something that people are not reading very much of anymore that I know of. Anyone out there read novels anymore? Why do you read them in a time like this? Because you want to escape. You need a good story, right? Or do you not have the time for it? I know people who are very smart who absolutely will not read a novel. They're almost arrogant about it. They say, well, I don't have the time for it. Well, I don't see it that way. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation. Savage. The Savage Nation. So we'll move on to other topics. We were talking about a novel, and you know, Reagan read all of Louis L'Amour's novels. I had never heard of Louis L'Amour till Reagan promoted him, and I read a few. I thought he was a really fine, you know, popular writer. I don't know what books George Bush has read recently. I think he prides himself on not reading. I believe he has boasted that he doesn't read. So I really don't know. It depends upon who the chief executive is of America. That's a great question. I mean, if I were to ask the three candidates some questions, I would say, who are your favorite authors? Obama. Well, that would be Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, and Reverend Wright. And Hillary, who are you? You know, I mean, you can make jokes about it. It's silly. Do they read books anymore? I doubt it. Who reads novels anymore? Some people do. But let's move on to other topics. Los Angeles, Cindy, 8:30 on the dial. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I have a question. I need your expertise. Every time I go to the pediatrician's office with my child, they're always trying to recommend new immunizations. And, you know, I have a two-year-old. My sister's son was autistic. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Am I crazy? Am I nuts for not
wanting? No. You're saying you are leery of the high number of immunizations that doctors are suggesting for infants. Is that correct?
I feel like I'm battling with the nurse. You know, why don't I wait? I'll come back, or I'll come next time.
No, well, you have the right attitude. Certain immunizations are very important. Some are very questionable, and some are harmful. Let me start with that. And I think you have every right to demand, not to ask, but to demand an answer out of your doctor as to the relative risk of various immunizations. You put them on the spot. Don't put them on a pedestal. Put the doctor on a spot. You're dealing with your child's health here. And if they're an expert in children, they should be very happy to answer your question. Ask them what percentage of children have developed illnesses from this immunization, this class of immunization. Now, which one worries you the most?
Well, with my first son, I gave him probably all of them till he's about 5. And then I got the waiver because I just didn't want to give him, I think, like the Prevnar A and B. There's just so many, you know, like hepatitis B. And,
right.
And I really...
many of them the children don't need other than the fact that they're going to school with illegal aliens who are coming in diseased and infected. They don't tell you that. That's a number one, that's a big problem, which is that they're bringing in illnesses that your child would not have been exposed to as near as 20 years ago. Right now, there are cases of TB coming into America. There are cases of other illnesses that had been wiped out in America that are now flooding into this country that the leaders don't care about because they're never confronted with it. They don't ride the subway. They don't ride the bus. Their children don't go to public schools. How old is the child you're concerned about?
Well, he's going to be 2, and I know you have a lot of expertise in epidemiology. And
Have you got a copy of my book, Healing Children Naturally?
I ordered your copy. That's how I got...
Okay, because no, I'm going to send you a free copy if you didn't get it. Stay on the line. I will... Oh, you have it. I'll send you one anyway. Get the lady's name, and I'll send you one for your best friend. See, here's a book that I'd like to see circulated widely across the world. I don't know how to say it to you. This could be perhaps the most important legacy I have of all. There are people who may not like my politics, but they also know that I know what I'm talking about when it comes to certain things. And I'll tell you, if I had a child, who would I turn to in terms of how to raise that child from a nutritional point of view? When you consider that pediatricians are often uninformed about nutrition, it doesn't mean they're bad people, but they are usually uninformed about nutrition. I don't think pediatricians today know enough about child feeding to provide adequate guidance. In fact, in my own experience, when my children were young, I found that pediatricians often know less about proper diet during states of illness and for maintaining the health of children than did most educated parents. I knew more than they did. That was before I had my doctorate in the field. So I would like to say to you that you need to turn to an expert or experts so that you're not sitting here in the dark just listening to the great doctor sitting there on a pedestal throwing down antibiotics. When I see that they're prescribing psychoactive chemicals for children as young as 2 years old because a child has anxiety or a child has fears, normal attributes of childhood. I was an anxious child. There was reason for me to be an anxious child. There was a lot of pain in my family and a lot of suffering. But what, they're supposed to put me on a pill for that? That's where parenting comes in. That's where religious teaching comes in. That's where family comes in, not pills. But when the doctors start throwing pills at your children, what they're doing is they're destroying their natural childhood. They're killing them, in essence. They're destroying them. So be careful. Be very careful. And then when they get sick, what are you going to hear? Just drink fluids? How many times have I heard idiots say, well, you have to drink a lot of fluids and take Tylenol? Couldn't be further from the truth. What diet should that child get if the child has illness A? Oh, you mean illnesses are different? Michael Savage, you mean illnesses require different diets? Well, you think about it. You think common sense would dictate that through the centuries, people didn't feed themselves and their children differently depending upon what complaint the person had, whether it be indigestion or the flu? So I did a whole book on various diets. Was it based upon my own knowledge? No, I went to the world's experts who had lived before me, and I put it together in Healing Children Naturally, my legacy. And I'm proud to tell you it's moving. Been moving. I don't need the money. I need the money like a hole in the head. You need the book.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation.
Got to work, like a slave all day.
50% of your time you got to work for taxes. All right, Tuesday, let's stop already. Tuesday's the day. That's the drop-dead day for taxes tomorrow. We were talking about death and taxes being the only certainty, and it was Ben Franklin who said that. You want certainty? He said death and taxes are the only certainty. And then we went from there to everything under the sun, boxing, this weekend, Vegas, novels. We had a novelist on with his new novel, Obama's hate preacher, who said the founding fathers were white supremacists. We had Obama calling Pennsylvanians bitter. You heard that already with guns or religion. I mean, this is amazing stuff. That Hillary said she knows God and she's had the Holy Spirit in her. I don't want to go there. I mean, please, I can't even imagine that. And now we're going to take the calls here on the Savage Nation. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio, WKRC. Michael, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michael. It's nice to hear you. I'm kicking myself for years lost. All these years I've been reading technical books. I fly for a living, and I read these things, but I've missed years of it. But I'm reading Hemingway. I just love the primal nature of Hemingway.
You know, it's funny you mention him because I grew up on Hemingway. He was my hero for years and years. I absorbed everything the man ever wrote.
My 17-year-old son and I, we love your logic and listen to you all the time. But it's led to Ellsworth Yeager, the amateur naturalist and outdoorsman, and to Irving Quimby, who showed me about global warming, Alan Eckert, where I live right now. And novels have brought so much to my life in a later age in life. I'm trying to give that to my son.
When you say you fly for a living, what do you pilot?
I fly a 727. It's a
That must be fun. You fly it with passengers in it or freight?
No, I fly for it's a cargo carrier out of Wilmington, Ohio.
Well, one of my goals is to own a 727 as a private plane.
This is a 198,000-pound gross weight aircraft. We normally load them up to about 170,000 pounds. Loads have been pretty good. Business has been okay.
That would be fun. That would be fun. Are they nice planes still, those early 7 Series planes?
It's one of the fastest around. The only one faster is a 747 or a Cessna Citation.
Well, what year was that plane built, the 27?
1961 is when the first test flights occurred. 1962 is when it was certified. And we're flying in the era of around 1970 to about 75 models.
Are they say, you know, I'm talking to a pilot who knows this stuff. If I get onto a leased jet, for example, and I hear it was built in 78, I know they're recertified with new engines and new avionics. How safe are they, the older ones?
They're just fine. They go through periodic inspections. As a matter of fact, ours go through D-checks every certain amount of time where they just tear it apart.
Are they probably safer than some of the commercial aviation that I see went on like last week? What went on with the MD-80s that they pulled them out of the sky?
Well, they tear these airplanes apart. They look for corrosion in places that you wouldn't want a doctor looking if you went to the doctor's office.
No, but I mean, did they not do that with the MD-80s?
Oh, they certainly do. The MD-80s are a fine aircraft. I've flown those, too. I flew for Midway Airlines. And the MD-80s...
So what's your favorite Hemingway novel?
The Hemingway novels?
Yeah, what's your favorite?
I love the Old Man of the Sea, just the primal nature of it. The man out there in the elements all alone, the same thing.
Yeah. No, I love that book.
I sit there.
Some of his short stories, when I was 18 years old and I first found Hemingway, I mean, I was so imbued with this man's life. I could not get enough of him. I couldn't get enough of the man's life. And the photographs of him on safari in Africa, the finca in Cuba, his fishing boat in Cuba and all of that. It's funny you should bring him up, Michael. It's almost psychic because I was lying in bed this morning and I was saying, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I could probably live like Hemingway did. Why don't I? And I thought about that. I said, why don't I? Why don't I go get a house in the tropics somewhere with a big fishing boat? I've been thinking about it. Why don't I get a house in the tropics with a big fishing boat? I could still do radio, couldn't I?
Well, certainly you could, from any place.
Right. The only thing I wouldn't do that Hemingway did is be a boozer. I mean, that's what killed him. His drinking killed him.
With a gun.
Yeah, well, I know, but his drinking led him to such depressions that he went into a psychotic depression. He put a shotgun in his mouth. But, you know, that's as much a product, Michael, of him going, having gone to the Mayo Clinic and having been given did you know that they gave him shock therapies to treat his depression? And after the shock therapy, he couldn't think as clearly, and that's it. He killed himself shortly after that.
But what astounds me is such an intelligent man going beyond that point and tilting onto the other side. Why he couldn't find the logic to stop it. What causes a human not to be able to go back?
Well, because you're a man with tremendous will. You fly airplanes. You have to be pretty straight to do that. I mean, he didn't fly airplanes. The point I'm making is he was struggling with his own fears and his own whatever. And his depressions got to him. As I understand the story, having read it, Hemingway Inside and Out and everything about him, he went to the Mayo Clinic late in life to treat his depression, and the quacks gave him shock therapy, electroshock therapy. He came out, he could not conceptualize the way he did prior to shock therapy. He didn't want to live any longer. That's when he put the shotgun in his mouth. I'm running short of time, God. I have great interviews coming up. Quick call, Kirsten, Chicago, fire away. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I basically just wanted to tell you thank you.
For what?
Your book on healthy children. I credit you with saving our daughter. She has
saving your daughter from what?
She has leukocytopenia, which is an immune deficiency. And if you look at her hard enough, she'll get sick. But through proper diet and nutrition, proper exercise, she's healthy.
You know, Kirsten, this requires a very long time together. If you'll be kind enough to call back tomorrow at the, you know, in the show, we'll get into this again. I'm honored to hear that Healing Children naturally helped you with your child. I didn't think it was just simply being read for entertainment. Coming up next, thanks for the call, is Carl Anderson on how religious people and Catholics can save America. That's right. You heard me right. How religious people and Catholics in particular can save America. Boy, I can't wait for you to hear this one, because we sure need some saving in this country when you have hate preachers like Obama's preacher. Let's hear some positive stuff coming out of the pulpit, and you'll hear it right here on the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
The leftists in this country have hollowed out, destroyed, gutted our moral foundation. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll have replaced mom and apple pie. Christians, especially Catholics, have been targeted by the socialist liberals. But Carl Anderson is convinced that all is not lost. He's written a book called Civilization of Love, What Every Catholic Can Do to Change the World. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today. I appreciate the opportunity to have a few words with you.
Well, why did you write this book?
Well, the book, A Civilization of Love, is really an attempt to take seriously some of the teaching of John Paul II and Benedict XVI about how to treat one's neighbor. And so they've been talking about a civilization of love based on the concept of love of neighbor as what ought to really define the basic relationships between people and also define what the relationships ought to be within society. So that's kind of the idea. And what motivated me was reflecting on 9/11. And Knights of Columbus had a lot of members who were tragically killed that day, including a number of firefighters. And we just thought, you know, how do we keep faith with the great sacrifice that these individuals made for our country, and what kind of a country do we want to have going forward? So it ought to be a country that is consistent with their kind of sacrifice, and so we think that the civilization of love is the way to go.
It seems to me that most of the country has moved away from the moral foundations we seem to once had.
Well, I had an interesting experience here a few days ago. A former New York City firefighter who was at 9/11, terribly injured that day, told me, "I've read your book. You know, we had in the U.S. a civilization of love for a few days after 9/11. We have to have it again." And I think the kind of courage and dedication and self-sacrifice of men like that are precisely the kind of virtues that the country needs. And this is what the book is about.
You think we can still steer the country back to living with moral values?
I think you teach virtue by living virtue. And so we need people who will step forward and say, "I'm going to live this way. I'm going to witness to it." And people are going to see this, not in a in-your-face kind of way, but in a subtle, day-to-day, but meaningful way. These are the choices I make, and I make them based on these values. And so I think by witnessing in this kind of a way, we change society, we transform society. And we ought to pay attention to that witness. I mean, one of the things that is so striking to me, look at the values of the men who went into those two buildings and saved so many people on 9/11. And compare that to the kind of value system that's given rise to this huge, terrible financial mess with subprime mortgages and so many of these financial firms writing off billions of dollars. Shouldn't we be able to expect that the guys in the white collars have as much commitment to virtue as the guys in the blue collars that went into those two buildings that day?
Commercialism, entertainment, and the media seems to have played a major role in the loss of these values in America.
Well, certainly communications media and a lot of the entertainment media goes after the dollar, and it certainly brutalizes in a way and takes advantage of a lot of individuals, especially our youth, the kind of messages it sends them. And one of the ways it seems to me we can push back is by having families and individuals really take a stand in their daily lives and say, "Look, these are the values we're about. They're not these values. And we're going to make an effort to stand for treating people with respect, recognizing human dignity on the part of our neighbors, and having a society that is more caring and respectful of people."
Is living with values going to make dealing with the world's problems like radical Islam any easier?
John Paul II, going back to him for a minute, you know, the Catholic Church talks about being a universal church. John Paul II was really the first pope who was a global pope. He traveled to, 100 times outside of Italy. And, he was looking for a way to connect with people of different cultures, different religions. And what he said was, "Look, all of us have this deep desire in our heart for love, to find love. And this is the universal value. And regardless of what religion or what tradition we come out of or what country we come out of, we all have families. We all look to provide and protect our children. And we have this in common. And so let's begin there. Let's find a commonality of all the traditions and religions," which he said is love, "and people of goodwill can join together to build this kind of a global culture, global civilization, if you will." So that's a starting point. So people understand we're not looking to hurt them, but we're looking for a common goal of mutual respect and cooperation and tolerance. Now, we also have to be realists and understand that there are evil people in the world that want to hurt other people, and we have a responsibility to protect the innocent from people who would do harm.
Is the new Pope, Pope Benedict, thinking along the same lines?
Well, there's two things that are very interesting about Pope Benedict. People think of him as only being Pope for 3 years. They don't recall that for 25 years he was one of the closest advisors to John Paul II. And so the way that both men view the world, how they cooperated together, there's a strong parallel here. And so John Paul II, Benedict XVI, they're independent and different people, but there's a very clear common vision. And both men have spoken very strongly about this idea of a civilization of love. In fact, I was with Pope Benedict just a few days ago, where he spoke again about the necessity of coming together to help people in need, to help people who are suffering, and in doing so, helping to build a civilization of love.
Well, Pope Benedict has already had some problems with the more radical Islamists. Is this going to change how he acts toward other religions?
Well, Pope Benedict, his entire professional life, and we have to remember his vocation is the vocation to the priesthood, but his chosen profession is that of being a scholar and university professor. His training is to speak very clearly and to try to identify points of difference and to understand clearly where the points of difference are as the first step to trying to reach, if not agreement, at least a mutual understanding. And so that's very clearly a part of his effort. Now, some people may see that as not being very diplomatic at times, but that's something which his experience leads him to, and which I think if we really want meaningful agreement, this is the first step. He is not going to back down from threats or from exaggerations of what he says. He's a man of extreme profound confidence and serenity, and that's a result of his deep spirituality, but it's also a result of his very strong intellectual judgment and study of these issues. And so I think you see that he's not afraid to speak what he thinks to be the truth, and he's not afraid to go places like he did when he visited Turkey amid many threats. So he's a man of courage who I think can, with his approach, do a great deal to further a meaningful dialogue or discussion among the religions of the world.
Carl Anderson, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Well, it was great to have this opportunity to speak with you, and I always enjoy listening to you.
Savage.
As you know, the Islamists are fighting us at war, not only with bombs and guns, but with stocks and bonds. Alex Alexiev with the Center for Security Policy has written extensively on the phenomenon of Wall Street Jihad. He's here to talk with us about it. Mr. Alexiev, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well, hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on. I feel privileged to be on your show.
You wrote an article called Wall Street Jihad. Were you talking about Sharia finance? Can you give us some details?
It's a piece that talks about a new phenomenon called Sharia finance. Fairly new and increasingly popular on Wall Street and elsewhere in the West, which in my view is a very pernicious phenomenon, ultimately very deleterious not only to our capital markets but to our security as well. What it is essentially an effort to legitimize Sharia, the Muslim law called Sharia, in the West by using financial tools to that effect. And it does that by convincing Western American banks and financial institutions to institute Sharia finance and hire Sharia experts as advisory personnel and gradually make this a popular financial instrument, first by relying on the kind of captive audience of devout Muslims, and then gradually spread to non-Muslims. It is, in my view, a very pernicious development because it pursues essentially a political objective, not a financial objective. And that, as I mentioned, is the legitimization of Sharia law in the West. Unfortunately, in my opinion, they have already made quite a bit of progress. You would have noticed that the Archbishop of Canterbury recently opined that the implementation of Sharia in the United Kingdom is unavoidable because we are already allowing them to have Sharia finance transactions. So this is a very, very disturbing phenomenon in my view.
What are we the people supposed to do to fight this?
We have to understand what it is. You're told by the promoters of the concept that this is an age-old Islamic practice, when in fact the concept is not a historical one. It had never existed in Islamic history until the mid-70s, when the first Islamic bank was started by Saudi Arabia. The reality of it is that it is an invented concept. This is the first thing that we have to understand. So once we understand that this is a an effort to strike political capital out of the ocean of liquidity that's sloshing around in the Middle East because of our oil revenues that we send to them, then we can start trying to do something about it and eventually stop it. The reason I'm saying that it has to be stopped is because the most significant thing about it is that the institutions, banks, and people that promote it do not really disclose what Sharia is. And that is, in my view, and in the view of many others that have studied the problem, lawyers and such, it is really against existing regulations for disclosure and material facts, et cetera.
Where does this Sharia come from?
Sharia is a, according to the Islamists, is sacred Islamic law that is based, it's God-given. It's based on the Quran, and it's for all times and mandatory to be followed by all Muslims throughout their lives. In fact, the reality of it is that it is none of the above. Sharia is a mostly man-made, post-Quranic code of jurisprudence, if you can call it that, which was put into practice by Muslim scholars and jurists up to two centuries after Muhammad, and it was done to serve the purposes of the Muslim potentates that ruled the Islamic world at the time, and to serve their purposes in terms of the largest expansion of Islam outside of Arabia at the time. And what that means is that Sharia has two parts that are very important to understand. One, which is basically unobjectionable, deals with devotional matters, how to pray, how to go to the pilgrimage, how to contribute to the Muslim tide, the so-called five pillars of Islam. But most of it deals with the relationship between Muslims and other people, including other Muslims, other non-Muslims. And there it is essentially a code of behavior that is highly, highly objectionable. In fact, it's obscurantist to a fault. It preaches aggression against infidels, against non-Muslims, and Muslims that do not practice the radical version of Islam. It also preaches that apostates from Islam should be killed. Adulterers, homosexuals must be killed. By the way, none of this is in the Quran. The reason that Sharia has become sort of the banner of the Islamists is because in many ways it's much more radical than the Quran. So these are the kinds of things that we need to understand. If you accept one part of Sharia, you have to accept all of it. And that means that if you accept Sharia finance, you have to accept what Sharia basically tells Muslims to do.
So they're using Sharia finance to try and take over Wall Street as well?
Well, yes. They're probably not that far along, but they certainly are making a lot of efforts. And the most disturbing part of it is that our Wall Street community has responded to that with such, not just alacrity, but I would say with enthusiasm. And it's a good question whether they really know what they're getting into, or is it simply because the potential profit, the potential transaction fees from Sharia finance are so huge that greed simply makes these people unable to see the reality of it. What Wall Street is doing and what it has already done, and by the way, virtually every major Western bank now has either an entire Islamic banking branch of it or what's called an Islamic banking window. So they are all into it. And none of them have taken the time, seemingly, to look at what exactly they're getting into.
Do you have any examples?
Let me give you just one example. Islamic banking, Sharia finance, is obligate banks and institutions practicing it to hire so-called Sharia advisory boards. These Sharia advisors essentially dyed-in-the-wool Islamists, because to become a Sharia expert, you need to go to a Sharia sciences faculty in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and most of them are really outright Islamists. And so these banks hire these people that hate the West with a passion. To them, Wall Street and all the rest of us are infidels. And they hire them at very lucrative fees. People tell me that they range anywhere from $20,000 to $100,000 a year to just sit there and tell the bank what's permissible and what's not permissible under Sharia. So here you have, just as one case, our Western institutions supporting the worst of the Islamists. Secondly, and it actually gets worse from there, the banking institutions that practice Sharia finance are obligated to give 2.5% of their revenues to what's called zakat, or the Muslim tithe. That's usually a minimum of 2.5% of your revenues. And the real problem there is that the donations, these donations are sent to charities usually picked by these same self Sharia advisors. In other words, by the Islamists, who obviously would steal the money to people of the same ilk.
So our own money can be used to finance the terror used against us?
Exactly. You have now a situation where some of these guys that are pulling the strings behind the scenes of Sharia finance have instituted a central zakat collection and distribution organization. And what that means is that you could end up very soon, if not already, with an organization that is able to distribute perhaps $10 billion a year, most of it Western money, to whatever jihadist or extremist organization they please. It is just a nightmare scenario, and it'll be quite legitimate.
What can we do about this?
The first thing that needs to be done is we have to get the Securities and Exchange Commission to look into that, because many of these banks are simply not obeying the existing rules and regulations for disclosure, for instance. I mean, if you have on your board, on your bank board, Sharia advisory board, a gentleman who is well known as a jihadist, who preaches that suicide bombing is okay, who encourages Muslims to engage in violence, you are, as an institution, very liable if something happens to where, let's say, one of these people that follows his instructions does something bad. It's material support of terrorism. We have, after 9/11, the Patriot Act really kind of strengthened the regulations on money laundering and disclosure, and banks are now obligated to know who their clients are. Well, how about their own personnel that may be jihadists? None of these banks, and I'm talking about Dow Jones here and others of that caliber, have ever done the slightest bit of due diligence to find out who these people are. And it's not very difficult to do. If I can do it in 10 minutes on the internet, they certainly can do it too. The reason they don't do it is because they don't want to. We as individuals, as private citizens, certainly can do a lot, too. I mean, at the very least, if you have a 401k in some companies that practice Sharia finance, or in some banks or in some institutions of that nature, it is your right to ask them, why are you doing that? And to tell them that, you know, if you do things that ultimately will endanger me as a private citizen of the United States, I'm going to take my money elsewhere. That's a language they understand.
Alex Alexiev, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoy that, and again, appreciate being invited on the show.
Savage.
show opened with me talking about taxes. There are taxpayers and tax consumers. And you're not going to believe it, but half of American families, or taxpayers rather, half of you will pay 97% of the individual income taxes the government is going to collect this year. But what about the other half? The other half of Americans, who are taxpayers, will pay little or nothing. Yet they're going to receive billions of dollars in benefits. Isn't that nice? So there are two Americas. But you haven't heard the candidates talk about you, have they? It's not about the rich and the poor. It's about taxpayers and tax consumers. Now, as you well know, guys like Obama and even Hillary appeal mainly to the tax consumer, those who do not contribute the same amount that they take out of the system. And as you know, this group continues to grow exponentially. And the more money they steal from those of us who pay taxes, the bigger the government, and the bigger the government, the more they appeal to the, in essence, tax leeches, the tax consumers. And that, of course, is the death of America as you know it. It can't go on forever. It's not going on forever. And it will end eventually. Something has to save us. Now, Reagan came along, and he was the first one in decades to talk about this. He explained clearly to the American people what it was all about. He talked about individual rights. He talked about what a big state does, about a government, what it does. Who's really doing that today? Bush? That's a joke. Bush is the biggest developer of big government of any president in the last three presidencies. He grew the government bigger than any liberal would have been able to get away with it. So where does McCain stand? Does McCain talk about limited government? Does McCain talk about cutting down on expenditures and limiting government? I haven't heard him say that yet. Anyway, we get these idiots in the media, the midstream media, asking Hillary things about who faith, do you believe in God, did God talk to you? I don't want to hear any of that. I want to hear what she has to say about taxes. I want to hear what she has to say about Islamofascism. I want to hear what she has to say about closing the border with Mexico. I want to hear what she has to say about the drug scourge that's killing our children. I want to hear what she has to say about protecting us from the coming conflict with China. That's what I want to hear, not this rubbish that the media is throwing in our face like dust in the eyes of angels. Now, there's another story I want to talk about. This thing about the Mormon sect, the polygamist retreat. It is one of the great travesties of justice that you're witnessing here. Do you realize what this is all about? This is all based upon one anonymous phone call. One anonymous phone call from a 16-year-old who said that she was allegedly mistreated, raped, forced to go to bed with an older man. The raid followed a call to a domestic violence hotline. You know who runs them, don't you? Who runs the domestic violence hotlines? Mean face, clipped-haired, anti-Christian women's groups. That's who runs domestic violence hotlines. They have it in for men from the get-go. We're all against domestic violence, but you're telling me that an anonymous call from a so-called 16-year-old girl who they don't even know who it is, who says, I was beaten and raped by a 50-year-old husband, gives the state the right to break into a church and take away 416 children? Why, therefore, let me ask you this. What if one of you to make an anonymous phone call about an Islamberg or a mosque in your neighborhood and say that I'm a runaway from a mosque and my imam is telling the men, what, are they going to break into a mosque and take away children from their parents? Of course they wouldn't do it. Then why did they do it to these people in San Angelo, Texas? There's much more to this story than meets the eye. I am the only one in the media who is saying something stinks to high heaven. This story is rotten from the bottom to the top. And a caller to the show was the one who alerted me to the fact that this came out just a few days after Romney was seen being paraded around by McCain as a possible vice presidential candidate. So what's 2 and 2? 2 and 2 is 4. Romney, Mormon. Media hates Mormons. Romney, sect. Raid the sect. Sect, polygamy. Polygamy, rape. Romney, rape, sect. Don't vote for Romney McCain. Now, the media did this. The media is behind this. Why all of a sudden out of the blue did this happen? I don't know whether child abuse occurred there, but does that give the state the right to take away all of the children from all of the women? It does not. It's the state that's the criminal here. It's the state, the mean-faced, clipped-haired monsters in Child Protective Services who should be in an orange jumpsuit. Those monster beasts should be in an orange jumpsuit with handcuffs on for what they're doing to these poor people. And let me show you why I say this. A church lawyer today said that the 60 or so men who are still remaining on the 1,700-acre compound on the ranch, the men said they would leave the compound if the state would allow the women and children to return to the place with child welfare monitors. But state Children's Protective Services, where these monsters control, what the monsters control, those women said that they would not respond to the offer. They have no comment on it. I am telling you that they are the problem. The state is the problem. It's the women in Child Protective Services who should be in jail for what they've done to these people, in my opinion. Let them prove there was child abuse. And then if there was child abuse, then go after the man who abused that one child. You don't destroy an entire religious sect on the basis of an anonymous phone call, which may not even be true, by the way. They could have done it themselves. Texas officials who took away 416 children from a polygamist retreat into state custody? Do you know what's going on? Do you know what the women are saying? The women are saying that the children are being abused by these monster women who run Child Protective Services. They were taken away from their mothers. And what I would like to see happen is I'd like to see the lawyers who are going to represent these women and children break the state of Texas. I would like to see the Child Protective Services monsters put in jail for this. This, my friends, is very dangerous for you, whether you are a polygamist, doesn't matter. What if you're a Jew living on an Orthodox compound or in an Orthodox community in America, and someone makes an anonymous call that a girl is being abused? Do you want them to come and take away all of your children? Oh, you don't care about this because you're not a polygamist. But what if you're a Muslim and you see this going on? Do you want a state to come and break into your Islamburg and take away your children and women? Do you think you would like that to happen? Why do they get away with it with Christians? Because Christianity today is a beaten religion. I'm sorry to tell you this. This is the naked, unadulterated, frightening truth. Christianity has been beaten up so badly over the years that Christians can't even defend themselves in this world. They're the one safe target for the radical left-wing agenda. And that's what this is all about, in my opinion. This is a travesty of injustice, and this must be stopped and corrected. And I hope the 130 lawyers who are going to represent these women and children take the state of Texas to the bank.
Savage.